This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antek. On August 1st, BFM's Front Row aired a program about the Selangor Indigenous Arts Festival. During the course of that interview, a word long considered derogatory was used to describe Orang Asli in Malaysia. We have since apologised for the error, which was first brought to light by my guest today. Rashid Bin Issa is the director of the Ma Mary Cultural Village. Rashid, thank you very much for coming today, taking the time as well as sending that letter. Can I begin by asking, have the Selangor government acknowledged that letter and done anything about it?
Thank you, Chua. The Selangor government has extended a copy of a letter asking the organiser to explain themselves. But I've yet to receive the answer from the organiser, what sort of reasons they gave. As to date, I haven't received anything yet.
When was that letter dated, asking for an explanation?
It was right after I wrote the letter, a couple of days, and it was before the event. They were actually worried about the VIP getting to know about the things which I complained about.
Mm. Yeah, you took issues with a few things. One was the word used, the S word. It's derogatory and it should not be used, and it does not describe a tribe or a people. It's a word used from colonial times.
Yes, the word, if I may say, Sakai is no more in use. Really, it is a word that describes a people which we actually don't understand. It is sometimes say as wild, but the meaning of the word is actually people that do not conform to our kind of behavior. We consider them as bad. We consider them as rude, or we consider all these negative things are that word that describe that it can never be used, because it's a long time since I remember that it's been used. Even right after when independence, we don't describe the Aboriginal people as that, but in the dictionary, if you look at the college dictionary, it is connected to one, to the Aboriginal of Malaya, and two is the word uncouth. If you look at the meaning again is all the negative aspect of a person. So describing a group of people is really not. Not accurate, not appropriate, not accurate at all. And what I objected to the organizer was they do not understand the meaning of tribe. They do not understand the meaning of the grouping of the Orang Asli, and neither do they understand the meaning of the word Sakai. So in the Orang Asli category, they have three categories. So the ones that is called the Semang by us, or the Nekrito by the scholars, little black people. And then we have the Senoi, which refers to only as people, I mean, and the Melayu Asli, which is my kind of blood. So all this has got six different tribes. So this, we have got six in Semang, we have six in Senoi, and we have another six in the Melayu Asli group. So this has to be clear within the grouping. The grouping is because of the similarity in the culture. Right. So if you do not understand this, then it will be very, very difficult to actually differentiate these different grouping.
Other than terminology, you also pointed out that the festival was appropriating intellectual property using the image that belonged to the Ma Mary Cultural Village that cost money to brand and market. This is the image of the Masman of Malaysia, which I guess the organizer, Tourism Selangor, used in their promotional materials. Has this always happened in the past? Is this the first time that this infringement has happened?
Well, it has been taken for granted for a very long time that we can use anything that we photograph. And the rights of the photographer is protected, while the rights of the people that has been photographed, it's very vague. Who has the more right, whether the person or the people that is promoting the person or the photograph that has been taken. This is really my concern, because I've seen this man being portrayed everywhere. If you go to the district of Kuala Langat, you'll see him, very big display, and then if you go to Chinatown, you go another one, and being displayed in the billboard. So if you go to, even coming back to KLIA 2, you see on the right hand side as you come along the corridor, and you see a big man with a mask on. So these are the things which I, some are with my knowledge and some are without. But as far as this festival is concerned, I know it's been, 4 years since they organized the thing. They've been twice, on two occasions I saw them using this masked man of Malaysia, which we introduced about 4 years ago. This guy, I know him for a long time. He's been using that mask, and his father has been using it, he says. And he's had some changes to the appearance. And that's why we brand him as the masked man of Malaysia, because if you see his house, he's got lots of carvings as well. And the origin of carving is reflected in many of his work. And the unique thing about this masked man of Malaysia is he doesn't sell his work. All he give away to people that he special, he considers special to him. And that's why using his name would be, you know, like taking advantage of the cultural village in a way that we have been promoting him, and we are fortunate to have Google assisting us so that he can stop whenever you Google.
Really?
You see,
it was a concerted effort from
there. A lot of people put in. So you can see from my description of how the Mamre Culture Village come by is by effort by many people, not just me. And for your information, I am not number one in propagating and helping, advocating the Orang Asli Mamre. I'm number five. If you look. Right. So it's 1926, there's somebody who wrote a book about them. They already written, they call the enigmatic people, they call them many strange names as well. Because we don't understand these people. It was Dr. Abbott, I think. And then after him was Datuk Sharub Yook, remember the director of the Antiquities Department. And then there was Professor Roland Werner, a medical doctor from University of Malaya. He spent a lot of time and wrote a lot of books. And then it was Anthony Ratos, the school teacher who collected a lot of work and improvised a lot of the work of the Mamre people. And then I came in. Oh, that's a long time ago. I couldn't remember, 20-odd years. I know of all of them except Dr. Abbott. He was long gone before I came. So I managed to talk to all these three gentlemen before me, and we share the same view. These people are really not what they seem they are. So we have been misled by the way they reacted at things. And so little we know about these people, because when I stayed with them, understand the language, speak the language, then we realized that they're not really what they appear to be. For example, their language is really strange. It's the Malay language. It is exactly the same word we use, but they're using it in a different pronunciation, different meaning, and it's not a dialect at all. It's totally different way of speaking, yet it is the same language. And many of the imported words are, again, very special. We have words that is onomatope. We say that words originated from the sound of things. So that's why the tiger is, you know, the roar of the tiger. The bird is the sound of the bird chip. You know, well, there's a lot of words which I find this is fascinating. With the Mamre people, that's why I've been there a long time, and so much things to be discovered. And really, the word we use, the words Sakai we use for generalizing the Orang Asli, will certainly not be appropriate for these people. It will be unfair, because they're so advanced in their culture. I heard you know, in the interview, I was trying to explain about the Harimau Berantai, the most prized of all the sculptures, which we got UNESCO award for it. See, the real meaning is quite simple, really. The tiger was caught in a trap for wild boar, and they had to replace the spirit of the tiger, so they carved the Harimau Berantai. But what is special, when I had to answer to the board that decides to give us this UNESCO Seal Award, is what do they do with it? That's the question. What do they do with this nice sculpture? So my answer is they throw it away. Ah, this fascinates the Japanese, the Indonesian, they were there, the Thais. They said, they tell us more about this throwing away bit. So I say the aspect of sustainability is already been discovered and realized by these people, that anything you destroy, you have to replace. And this is a way of discouraging people from, you know, destroying wild animal like tiger. So they had to carve this sophisticated sculpture and leave it where the tiger had died. But unfortunately, people like us, these modern people, pick it up and, you know, take it home and put it in a museum and sell it. So these are the things that, you know, we are so far backward than these people. And thanks to Sharon Yop and, you know, Roland Werner, we made this popular, and now it is one of the most expensive wood carving ever. So it may cost, you know, like I've heard of people selling 100,000 for such a sculpture, you know, so which is, you know, about 20 years old. Okay. So these are the things which we are very proud of the Mahameri, and we should be looking at more things. So not only the language, I said, you know, the aspect of sustainability, and, you know, what about the religion? So these are the things which people come to the Mahameri Culture Village to hear from me. So on. So I have something like 500 to 1,000 people in a month. And I am talking and talking. You know, right now I have to... No, I was told tomorrow I had to come, you know, there are students graduating on the guiding course. So they want me to spend an hour with them, questions and answers only. So these are the things which I am really proud of, being there and being part of the Mahameri people.
Let's take a short break and we'll come back and talk more about your work with the Mahameri Cultural Village. I'm speaking today to Rashid Bin Isa about representation of indigenous communities in Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. In the studio with me is Rashid Bin Isa, director of the Mahameri Cultural Village. We've been talking about some of the oversight by the Selangor Indigenous Arts Festival on the appropriation of images of the masked men of Malaysia, as well as using a derogatory word to describe Orang Asli. Rashid, you've been living on Kerry Island since 1989, or been involved in Mahameri people since then. What brought you there in the first place? Well, how it started?
I started my college in UITM in Shah Alam. So I had an Australian lecturer, and he took me there. He took me to Kerry Island. So I had seen it in 1970s. So I've seen those people living in the houses and how they react to people. So, but it doesn't strike me as interesting at that point of time, because I see is these people, you know, carving strange things and throwing it away. But later on, when I, in 1980s, when I was really into the Orang Asli, so I realized that these people are very, very strange people indeed. They don't think like us, and yet they don't express it, they don't tell us what they don't want. And everything they do seems to be contrary to what they actually they are. So, for example, their name, the individual name, they got two names. Everyone has got two names. One we call an ecological name, the name associated with the incident happening on the day they were born. So one is called Princess Diana, so one is called Diana Ross, and the other one is Michael Jackson. So we have light bulbs and motor car and all sorts of names. But when you look at the identity card, it's a different name. So I was told that, you know, in the journal, Kerry once wrote that he doesn't like the name they told him, because some can be very very strange and comical, like, you know, he can be a swine or a dog or something like that. So he suggested that they should have a name which is common, which is normal. So the Englishmen give them Henry or John or William. So if a guy is an Indian guy who registered them as a worker at the plantation, they will call him Sami or Mutu or whatever. If a Chinese guy, will give him a Chinese name. But they don't care. They don't seem to care at all about what they're called or what they're written in the identity card. But amongst themselves, they have a set rules. And this is the thing that interests me and the people before me.
What were you studying when you first visited there?
Oh, this is the strange thing. A lot of people ask me, what do I do? Well, I started off with statistics. So when I have finished, then I went to the UK. So I happened to qualify for a computer science course. It's a very, I would say a difficult thing to do at the time, because the computer was just starting to be built. Small computers are virtually non-existent. So we work on very large machine, and we had to do, you know, physical thing to the machine. We have to actually remove tapes and load things and connect physical communication with other computers. These are, even you cannot ask the computer for the time. You have to write a program to tell you the time. So these are the things which we have to do at those days. And gradually, after 4 years, when I graduated, well, I do online banking at the time. I was exposed to the banking system in England. So I joined the bank. I only worked for 10 years.
You say only, but 10 years is a long time. When, how did you decide, or when was it that you decided you're going to make this your life work?
Yes, what I do when I was studying in England for 5 years was I like to travel. So 3 months in a year, I would go places. I would try to go anywhere, literally anywhere, but with very little money, so I had to hitchhike. I had to get ride from people. And eventually, first year and second year, but I wanted to reach Malaysia one time, whether I can go overland. It was extremely difficult at that time in the 70s. God, it was a lot of war. There was the Iranian Civil War, I remember, and then there was this the Russian, the Taliban, and Afghanistan. You know, this is impossible to go. But it was, when traveling, you see a lot of people fighting. So it was frightening, but then it was quite safe in a way. There was a lot of army and people all over the place, but you just don't want to land in the wrong place. So the trip was a nightmare for me, going over to Malaysia by overland. It was a nightmare. It was so disgraceful for me that I don't want to share this with anyone. But little did I know the stories, that the things that I saw was things which are what people want to hear. So these are the things. I am fortunate to see a lot of things. Indigenous people, staying with them, staying with the Bedouin, staying with the Indian people, and lots of places. I've been to the pyramids, to anywhere, you know, that I can go at the time. It was something like, I don't know, 20-odd countries which I live in. Yeah. So this is how, when I came back, I only lasted 10 years working, and then I got this itch to stay with them. So for 13 years, I stayed in a village with no electricity, water, or anything, and start from scratch. Mm. Now I'm teaching the Orang Sli how to live in the wild.
That's interesting, because you've said in an interview a while back that the Marmari people have now shifted their attention more towards, you know, performing for visiting tourists instead of focusing on preserving their way of life or traditional culture. Is this something that you still see happening, you know, managing the preservation of culture in the face of modernity, or has it, have you managed to arrest that kind of development?
Yes, I think the Marmari has demonstrated to all the other communities that they can do it. Really, in spite of some might not like it, so we cannot help that. And maybe out of jealousy or competition, or, but we have expanded to the village we are in, Sungai Bumbun. We have already expanded to Sungai Rambai, which they specialize in origami. I wrote a book on the origami, and we got the Malaysia Book of Record for attempting 8,888 in 2 days. And then we've done the premiere of all is to showcase the Puja Pantai, which is the annual celebration of the spirits. This is very significant in a way that they are the most difficult for me to deal with, because these people do not want to share, do not want to show what actually transpired when the door to the other world opens on that day. So how they do, there's so many things which I misunderstood and did not foresee, that these people are actually very, very serious on that particular half day which they celebrate. But now they are coming forward. They wanted to people to come and see what they're doing, which is strange. People come in, believe me or not, people come for healing. This is one of the trends. They actually go to these villages to get the advice, healing. So, and for me, I don't just look at things on the, you know, the cultural aspect, but I want, as a people with science background, I want to see the science of it. So how do you heal people by just, burning incense, for example, and then how do you get lottery numbers, for example? This is my interest, because I've seen them being very successful. I've seen many people got lottery numbers. So these are the things which I wanted to learn from them, how they actually get rid of their fears and their concerns. And this is fascinating. Puja Pantai is one that has been greatly publicized. We have got reporters from all over the world looking at this very small event. There are more of us than them, really. So on one occasion, we have about 500 reporters as compared to only 50 of them. So, but yet, you see the interest going. Hopefully, I want a recognition for this celebration.
When does this happen every year?
Yeah, it's around the Chinese lunar calendar, after the Chinese New Year. It's 1 month. It's where every village, they believe that this door will open, so you can communicate with the other world, or the other world will come to the this world. And it is really something to see with these people. They believe, they strongly believe in the spirit, and they represent the spirit, and they seem to be the spirit now when they are. And this is fascinating for us, and this shouldn't be forgotten in spite of many that criticize that this is wrong, especially the religious people. It's got nothing to do with us, really. It's with them. We are built differently from them, so what we think best for us is not necessarily good for them.
I have read that the Marmari history goes back more than 10,000 years. How do we know, how would you know this, and where did they come from, and how did they arrive on the peninsula?
Well, Joa, one of the things, being science-based people, we don't see things like the scholars, normal scholars would think. When I got there, I don't want to see descriptions, you know, like, oh, those are Mongoloid people, these are Austronesian people, because these are all comparison based on languages, because appearances, you know. So the first thing I did was get their DNA. So not for anything, just compare to me, whether I'm part, how many percent of me are like them, you know. So my surprise is there was nothing common about the Malay people and the Mamre people. So I had to get at least 50 samples to send to the chemistry department to qualify for any comparison. So when they've got the minimum of 50, which I've chosen myself, because I know they are not mixed with any other races, I know they are pure line. So when they came out with the result, it was a surprise to me as well. They were not similar to any of the people around us, not the Chinese. We thought they were Chinese. No, the Mamre people was never Chinese people, although there are a lot of Khmer language in their vocabulary, but they are not of the Chinese blood. We're not Indian or Arab or anything, because, but if we trace it to 25,000 years ago, then we see that the origin of these people. So we reckon that, you know, we know that the Semang people migrated out of East Africa 70,000 years ago. They walked something like 7,000 miles. It took them 7,000 years, according to some researchers, to reach the north of Malaysia and south of Thailand, and which later on they walked to Irian Jaya and then Australia. Well, it was possible at that time because the continents were different. The water level was 100 feet or more below. So Indonesia is connected to us, so is the Philippines. And Australia, maybe they can just walk. So it is possible at the time. And then we have the newcomers, like the Polynesians and the Malay people, basically we call them the Melayu proto, which are very quite recent, 10,000, 15,000. But the middle group, called the Senois, we call them the Senois, are very, not very specific. We don't know where they come from. Some suggest that they come from the north, from south of China, Yunnan, some. So a lot of suggestion, but there are six different tribes there. So some also suggest that the Negrito or the Semangs marry the Malay, Proto-Melayu, and then becomes the Senoi people. But how come I'm not related to the Mamre? So this theory about the mixing is also not right. So we reckon that around 25,000 years ago, there are movement of people around this area. These are probably the Senoi people or the Mamre people, because they do not represent any group which is common now. So at that time, they must have come from the north because of the languages. But when I had the vice president of Taiwan, who was very interested, so we had a personal appointment with me. We sat the whole day. He wanted to know whether he is related to the Mamre people. It's the vice president who...
How come?
...had a personal... He wanted to know. So I did not... At first, I did not... I thought he's going to be related to the Mamre for sure. When he has done his research before that, having a PhD in anthropology, this guy has done his homework. And then all the other things aside, and the final part of the meeting was conversation. So we are going to compare languages. We're going to speak the Mamre versus the people in Taiwan. He is indigenous. So he was so surprised that he doesn't match at all. There's no word that he recognizes, and the Mamre doesn't recognize. So what was funny when I said, why don't I speak to, you know? So we had a conversation in my language, and he speaks in his native language. I was surprised. This was a real surprise because mata is eyes and kaki is the leg, and so many words, you know, is similar. So the Taiwanese indigenous group, which he belongs to, are actually Malay people. So that what the conclusion was. And then he said, what my great-grandfather used to do is eat something, a leaf, he says. He chewed this leaf and it turns red. Can you get this for me, he says. Because I know the taste, because I always sneak and try the taste, he said. So we had to climb this betel nut tree and get the betel nut leaf and all the slime stuff. He waited. And he chewed it just like the Orang Asli did. All red in the mouth. Vice President, you with the ambassador and all. So it was, it is an eye-opener. So these are some of the people we meet, which you know, really we learn more than those people who visited us, rather more than what I told them during this meetings.
Yeah. Going forward, I saw in a news report that this government is relooking at the feasibility of this 200 billion ringgit port city project on Kerry Island. And recently, the Prime Minister has also met with the Tamiya community from Kelantan to assure them he will resolve the customary land encroachment issues, and the Rural Development Ministry will look into gazetting Orang Asli customary land. Going forward, do you see changes in the way how the government is reacting to issues that are affecting Orang Asli communities, or do you see it still responding to, in an ad hoc basis?
Well, sadly, I think we are moving too slow, really. Simply because this is a small committee, it's insignificant. If it's a large community to change them, I think there will be lots of changes that we can do. But the will and the strength to do this with small community, I don't think it's there yet. We tried to do before with the legislation and with the administration, but it is not happening because only the name changed from Jabatan Hal Ehwal Orang Asli, which is the agency which is taking charge of the Orang Asli. This is very much different from anywhere else in the world. Malaysia has got this unique protection for the indigenous people. We have a Act of Parliament. The Act 134 guarantees the right of existence in the country, and they guarantee them in Parliament. And they also guarantee that they can vote, they can be elected as a member of Parliament. This is very much different. You don't find this anywhere else in the world, I think only in Malaysia. Yet, we are no more better than anywhere else. Because maybe we do not pay attention to what we are doing. For example, we have these people demonstrating and meeting the Prime Minister and presenting their case on loggers and stuff. This is very sad, I think. We have a department that take care of this. So this department should be doing this rather than protecting these people. See, things like this should not happen. In Kerry Island, you see, they are... The island is a fifth the size of Singapore and probably nearly half of Penang Island. And yet they are staying on less than 1% of the island. And why is this? Why is it so difficult to give them, land, you know, land which they want to live off by? You know, they need resources. Now we cannot get even the palm leaf. And we are destroying the nearby mahogany timber. You know, this is the most expensive timber in the world, and yet we're destroying it every day. We cannot do anything that will assist them. This are
part
this
of the is reason is because the land belongs to a company, isn't it? A private company.
Yeah, we have some technical issue over land matters, because land belongs to the state. So once it's gazetted into Orang Asli land, then it doesn't belong to the state anymore. So this has been a stumbling block for the Orang Asli land issues. No state wants to gazette. So if you look at Kelantan, for example, virtually no gazetted land. I think probably 1 acre or something. So and now there's a move to give them, a plot of land around the house, you know, to be gazetted as their own. These are all not solutions to things. We have to look at how they live, what they want to do with themselves, you know, rather than what we want for them. So if you give them a house, for example, if you look at Bukit Lanja, they're all given house and bungalows. Does it work? It doesn't work because they don't stay there. They go elsewhere. You build them a brick house now, everyone gets this 8,000 ringgit house or something. This house is still, they are building a house next to their house, which they think is more comfortable, but we think they are more comfortable on the brick houses. These are the things we have to be resolved. We have to move forward like we did with the cultural village. The government was brave to spend 5 million ringgit to build the complex and let the private people to run. So hopefully these private people will be all Mamiri people and they will go the direction they want to do. And then more of this private and public partnership can exist, you know, in other areas. If the Mamiri people can do it, why not? So we have the Samai community, which is over 50,000 people. So it's the Tamiya people, it's also 50,000. It's a lot of people. It's a lot. So a lot of things we can do with these people, not just in the tourism industry, but in agriculture, in sports. I've never seen these people taking part in sports, yet I have seen them walking, I don't know, without food for many, many days, which I have done this with them. It amazes me that they can have this stamina and this resilience over, you know, walking for miles and miles without eating and drinking. So these are the things which we can use in sports, for example, so we can put them to a test. We'll see, you know, whether they can be world champions.
The Council of Eminent Persons just announced that their term has ended yesterday, and I understand that you've given some recommendations to the Institutional Reforms Committee, so hopefully some of those recommendations would be included in the final report to the Prime Minister. Where can people go to get more information about the Mamiri Cultural Village? Is there a website or a place they can contact you?
Yeah, we have a small website, but we don't want to print things which people nowadays, it's very common to cut and paste things. So to be fair with these people, I advise people to go and attend our packages. So there are various packages. For the schools, we have one, and then we have the common people, or and then we have the specialized packages, which I myself do. Mm-hmm. These are the things which is I feel be fair, because when we face each other, we can ask the questions that is fair to these people. If I said, for example, you know, the Mamiri woman can have more than one husband, then it will shock everybody. So the Malaysian probably. So I cannot put this in print because this thing is practice, but it is not what we think, because they do not marry out of love, personal attraction, or sex. This is something unique about these indigenous people. In the old days, our forefathers, they don't marry. They marry to enlarge families. That's why it's a big difference. If personal attraction is one of the criteria of marriage, then we can have a same gender marriage. So for them, this will be very, very strange because it cannot happen. So I have a group representing this community that have face on with me. So we had a very nice communication. They came in a very big group to see how these indigenous people solve these differences. Because now the wave is same gender marriage is commonly accepted, and some people resisted that. So there are things which we can learn from this ancient community, because they have gone through the time. So how they deal with sex before marriage, how they deal with the same gender marriage, how they deal with many aspects, forced marriage, is all in place. This is what I'm there for. You know, I stayed there and I observe this thing, and I'm sharing this with people. And we have up to 1,000 people a month, which I have to talk to. Either directly they come to me, or they go via the email and the other means. So these are the things which I don't want to actually write in website, that, you know, and then print books, and which will be in the end unfair to these people. We have to be fair with these people, because we think differently from them. So we have to understand it from the basic principle. They are, to me, and we should be thinking, they are earlier than us, they are more advanced than us. In no way that they are primitive, as what we always think of them.
Rashid bin Isa, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you, John.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.